Thanks so much for joining us today on WPIR News. We're turning our attention to cranes. You know, late last month, I think it was, a female whooping crane named Ducky died from highly pathogenic avian influenza. Ducky lived in the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, a lovely place to visit. But her death was the first time a hooper has died in North America from this flu. And so now scientists at the International Crane Foundation, of course, are working to safeguard the remaining flock. And we're going to talk with a couple of guests from the foundation about the status of the Hooping Crane Foundation. International Crane Foundation. And Ann Lacey's one of them, been with us a number of times, director of the foundation's Eastern Flyways program in North America. Ann, welcome back.
Well, it's so good to be back. Thank you.
And Dr. Diane Boone, Diana is director of conservation medicine at the foundation. Diana, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Questions about avian influenza, maybe, or maybe about the Crane Foundation itself. I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe we could just start by talking about highly pathogenic avian influenza. Just what really is it?
Yeah, thanks, Larry. So avian influenza showed up in North America in late 2021, 2022, and it has been decimating wild bird populations in addition to causing problems with commercial poultry, some of the production farms for some of the game birds, and last year in dairy cattle with it being found in the milk that they produced. It is a highly infectious disease. It evolves really quickly, so we're seeing some more and more virulence in the virus, and we're seeing with the ducky and the whooping crane that died, that they've been at Horicon Marsh for years as part of the reintroduction program. And to have this be the first time is really an indication of how widespread this virus is becoming and how much of a problem it's becoming for wild populations.
So it happened right on the International Crane Foundation grounds?
It actually happened. We released cohorts of chicks each year, and 8 chicks had been released and were in basically a soft release pen at Horicon Marsh, and that's where Ducky picked up the virus, and that's where Ducky died.
So the International Crane Foundation grounds have not experienced...
No.
And chime in here, Ann.
Yeah, that's what when we found out that after Ducky passed away and testing indicated that she was positive for HPAI, that initiated a whole string of precautionary measures that we've had in place for years, but we have it in levels, and Diana has, and people before her have had these protocols set up, so we know what to do when there is avian influenza in the state or in the county or, God forbid, on our site.
Yeah.
And so we went from stage nothing to 4, which is the highest precaution on our site, to protect our birds that are resident on our site, but also our staff and then our field personnel that are going off-site, on-site to these places. So that was initiated immediately.
Yeah. Well, and as I think about it, I mean, they're occurring in places where the birds are in close concentration. I mean, there's thousands of geese, or there's thousands of chickens in one building.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is way different than
not natural. Yeah.
Than what you have at the Crane Foundation.
Yes. Yeah. So our site is clean. So we made sure that we passed that incubation period that is requisite, I guess is the word for it.
Yeah.
We made sure that our site was clean, but we maintain those protocols for staff coming and going from areas that may have the virus. So we just assume that if it's out in the field where there are waterfowl present, that it could be there, and we make sure that we separate that distance,
yeah.
that there's a break between our field work and on site.
Well, hoopers are, I think they're high, they call them highly endangered, isn't it? I mean, remind me what that actually exactly means.
For whooping cranes, it means that there are only, right now we have 65 in Wisconsin. There is an estimated about 560, 575 in the wild population flying between Aransas and Wood Buffalo National Park in Canada, so the original population. So that's not very many of any one species. So it is a very endangered species. And the reason for the population here in Wisconsin is to get a self-sustaining population that will eventually contribute to the downlisting of it, so it will no longer be endangered.
Yeah. And for those who aren't familiar, I mean, they're not necessarily all that easy to tell if you see one flying them 400 yards away, but what do they look like?
So people are familiar, I hope, familiar with our sandhills. Very, very ubiquitous in the state. Gray, still big. They stand on two legs and can look you in the eye. But when you see a whooping crane, they are lily white with those beautiful black wingtips. So the big, big white bird with black wingtips flying with sandhills, maybe?
Yeah,
it'll be a whooping crane. Yeah.
And how big a threat do you think the avian flu is to the hooper population, Diana?
I think it's a very substantial threat because what we see is mostly during migrations, so the spring and fall migration. And we know that we lost, we don't know the exact numbers, but up to 2,000 to 3,000 sandhill cranes on their wintering grounds this past spring. And whooping cranes, are tightly interwoven in those flocks. So if we're seeing that amount of death with sandhill cranes, there's a really good probability that the chance of exposure for whooping cranes is higher and higher with each season, and there's more prevalence of the virus in the environment.
So I'm trying to figure out, what do you do to spread, to keep this, our limit, I guess. We're not going to get rid of it entirely, I don't think, but what are people doing to try to limit the spread of this disease among cranes?
You know, that's a great question, and it's for cranes and it's for wild bird species in general. We don't really have a vaccination that's been approved. The only species that has is California condor, but that is in discussions. We also talk to a lot of people about, is there ways that we can kind of monitor the virus and have an idea if it's coming to a certain area? Do we watch those cranes a little bit closer? And then the rest of it is really just being aware of where the virus is, how the virus presents, because we're not going to go and catch the 65 birds that are in Wisconsin and bring them back into captivity for a multitude of reasons. They are wild birds. They do get exposure. The hope is that they develop some immunity with continued low doses of exposure. And a lot of the conversations that have happened in the zoo veterinary world, wildlife veterinary world, is, your exact question, how do we protect our birds, and how do we make sure that we're not having mass mortality? So there's a lot of mostly preventative measures that are in place, or monitoring measures as much as possible,
keeping them. I'm just trying to, my daughter is works at the she graduated from college last year in biology and is now at the Topeka Zoo, where she's got a full-time job there. But I was down there visiting, and you're in the avian areas. You might see birds flying in from wherever, or, ducks, wild ducks coming in and sitting amongst the other ducks.
I see this. There's two prongs. So that's something that we do on our site up in Baraboo to keep our cranes safe, is we can exclude waterfowl either by top netting or putting our birds inside. But something else to consider with wild birds is ensuring that they have enough habitat where they can spread out. It's those concentrated groups of birds, like you were saying. And that has There's been other populations of cranes that were hit very, very hard in those first years where highly pathogenic avian influenza first came out. Eurasian cranes in the Hula Valley of Israel, hooded cranes in Izumi in Japan. And that was one thing that we had always thought it was going to happen, and sure enough it did. And so this year also happened with sandhills. So ensuring that we have adequate habitat all through the flyway so they can spread themselves out and be at less risk, that's key as well.
On those flyways, though, they like to stay together. I mean,
I think some of it is, yeah, they like each other's company, maybe. Or sure. There's safety in numbers, certainly. But some of it is also driven by there are fewer and fewer places that they can find safe roosting in those shallow, large, shallow, open wetlands.
So, oh my gosh, I'm looking here and thinking it's time for us to take a little short break. And just a reminder that we're talking with Diana Boone, Director of Conservation Medicine at the International Crane Foundation, and Ann Lacey, who's Director of the International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. Questions for them, maybe about avian influenza, but maybe about the International Crane Foundation or cranes in general. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with a couple of folks from the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, Dr. Diana Boone and Ann Lacey, and Diana's Director of Conservation Medicine, and Ann is the Director of International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And when, you know, for those who aren't familiar, maybe we should talk a bit about the International Crane Foundation. Would you give us the background of the organization?
Well, the International Crane Foundation has, since its humble beginnings in Baraboo, Wisconsin, we are 52 plus years young. Yeah, so we have been going strong for that many years. International conservation, helping people and communities as well as cranes in 50 countries and 5 continents. But at our site in Baraboo, we have all 15 species of crane that exist worldwide. It's the only place in the world that has them all. And we tell their story, tell the threats to them, and how we are working to ameliorate those threats to keep them and their ecosystems secure.
Well, I have to tell you, I've been going up there for years and years, but thinking back to the sort of the original site, and this is the same site, but and what you have now after that big remodel, how many years? It's not that long ago.
We were supposed to open in 2020, so we had a little bit of a delay there, but so much the better. But yes, yeah, brand new exhibits and visitor center, and it's still even new to us, even though it's now about 5 years old.
It is amazing, and I guess my point is, if you visited 10 years ago and you think, well,
come on back, yeah,
it's I've been there once. You're gonna be really surprised.
And our nature trails, I can't yes. forget about our beautiful prairies. They were spectacular this year. It was such a good growing season.
Yeah. Joe in Menasha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. I have two little things. I spend a lot of time outdoors observing nature, including being quite aware of our honeybees and impact on crops, sprays and things on them, and butterflies and what have you, rabbits and birds in general. But I'd be very curious to hear if there's been time spent or allocated studying the effect of various crop sprays on sandhill cranes in particular, because of the impact on the immune systems of these animals. And if these sprays and eating those seeds and, you know, dropped crop particles, for example, if it is possibly creating a higher rate of avian flu susceptibility. And then as far as overcrowding, I agree. You know, these species enjoy hanging out together, although in many cases, sandhill cranes seem to kind of separate a little bit while they're raising their chicks. But as far as, let's take the Bay Beach Wildlife Nature Center, which has become extremely populated with geese, and I see a lot of unhealthy-looking geese and ducks, but what are they being fed? A lot of commercial crop corn. And I'm wondering if there is a connection. And so that was my comment. I'd be so curious to hear the answer.
Okay. Ann, do you want to take a crack at that?
I'll start and then pass it off to Diana, because that is a great question, Joe. Thank you. And that is something that I have been curious about for a long time. Sandhills are part and parcel with our agricultural landscape in Wisconsin. It's one of the reasons why it has had such a great comeback is we have a lot of wetlands, but also they have adapted to our human-dominated landscape and all that agricultural area. So Diana and I are actually starting a study looking at just what the exposure is, what these birds are carrying as part of the what agrochemicals they're being exposed to and carrying around. At the 10,000-foot view is that the population is growing and it's doing quite well. So it can't be a lethal effect, at least, but are there some sublethal effects? And that's one thing that we're looking for that way. And maybe Diana can talk more about what those things could be. You were talking about the immune system and more susceptibility to avian influenza, question
mark.
Yeah.
Diana?
Yeah, Joe, and I think that's a great question. You know, and I'm just going to start off that I don't have the answer for that yet. You know, the fact that we do see birds in the high congregations are more stressed and they're showing higher stress related behaviors. And we know that in multiple species and in humans that higher stress lowers your immune system. So, it's assumed that that is an issue, and a lot of these stresses that we're putting on cranes, are going to catch up with them at some point. And, you know, whether it's avian influenza or another disease or related to the agricultural use of chemicals is to be seen. You know, and I would say to your point on, you know, looking at waterfowl that are fed crops and stuff like that. I think that the one benefit with cranes is they're really omnivorous, so they have a pretty varied diet. So it's not that one thing in particular is going to have such a overarching effect on their total nutrition, because they have a lot of options available for them, especially in healthy wetlands.
Let's take an email here. Bill, this is a call. Bill had called but couldn't stay with us. How can you tell if a dead bird has avian flu, and what should you do with the bird if you think it died from avian flu influenza? Should you take it somewhere?
Bill, that is a fantastic question. Thank you for asking that one. During the migration season in particular, like the way that I look at it as a veterinarian is that if I see a dead bird and I see a dead wild bird, my first thought is avian influenza. Probably my second and third thought are the same answer. But there are other things that can cause deaths, and especially multitude of deaths. But right now we're just seeing such a prevalence of avian influenza. If you see a dead bird, I would report it to DNR, Wisconsin DNR. They're the ones that are going to be handling it, especially on a lot of the refuges. And there is a risk to people with this virus. So within the ICF staff, we really try to protect our staff by not having them touch dead birds without a lot of the personal protective equipment that we have on if we actually need to grab a bird, and especially we have all that on if we need to grab a sick bird. Gloves and mask and face shield, change your clothes. One of the biggest things too is that if you're in an area where you're seeing a lot of dead waterfowl in particular, be really cautious of the shoes that you're wearing and where your car's been before you go to another similar area, because you can transmit the virus both on your shoes, and it's mostly the wheel wells of your car. So what we'll do is we'll change shoes. So we have site-dedicated shoes. And if we've been somewhere, we just run our car through a car wash so that we know that we're not acting as a way to transmit that virus other places that it isn't already.
Yeah, regardless of whether it's avian influenza. And again, you know, Occam's razor says it might very well be. It's great to report it, because if it's not that, it might be something else. All of it is something we should know about and be concerned about. So, yeah, search the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources site for dead bird report or something like that. It'll get you to the site, and it's really important to report those.
Good question. Michael emailed us. Michael says that between 2009... I forget. He doesn't give the second. I don't have the second. He had a range here. He thought that about 80, somewhere between $80 and $100 million was spent on captive breeding whooping cranes and four release projects. The first two releases didn't work. Have the remaining two projects produced self-sustaining populations of hoopers?
Yeah, he's thinking of how much it costs to raise a whooping crane, and that's something that we're actually trying to document. You know, it's a lot of money.
He was taking a guess there from the sound of it.
Yeah, and that was the early days of our whooping crane reintroduction here in Wisconsin, when we had multiple different release techniques, including the ultralight migration, which we don't do anymore, but it still costs a lot of money to raise these birds up, raise them right, put them out in the landscape with our partners. There have been two previous reintroductions. The first was Gray's Lake out in the Rocky Mountains for whooping crane migratory population, and a non-migratory attempt in Florida, and those did not work out. So there are two current ones here in Wisconsin and another non-migratory population that is ongoing down in Louisiana that is doing great. They have at least 80 birds in their population now, not yet self-sustaining. Obviously, ours in Wisconsin is not, but the one in Louisiana, non-migratory birds have a lot less threats and a lot less risk to their life during the annual cycle. But they do have their threats down there, and the challenges continue, but it's looking very, very good for that population.
And thinking about funding, how do you guys fund the International Crane Foundation? After all, it's a foundation.
It is. We're a member-based organization, so we would love for people to become a member and join our flock to support our work globally. But we have a lot of private foundations, and our grant writers are working 24/7. They are the best to help us fund our many, many projects worldwide. But the whooping cranes in particular were supported by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. These being an endangered species, these are property of the people. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service kind of takes the forefront of, you know, all whooping crane populations, both in human care and in the wild. And so that is a lot of our support comes from them. And at this difficult time, we think of our friends in the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we'll wish them well.
Yeah. Bob in Kewaunee has a quick question. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Well, good afternoon. Well, first I'd like to say that I have been fortunate enough to have several sightings here in the Kewaunee area of whooping cranes, always a single crane, and almost always in the company of sandhills. Which brings me to my question, will they interbreed with the sandhills?
Will they? Well, they have. that first reintroduction that I described out in the Rocky Mountains, those were whooping crane eggs that were placed in the nests of sandhills because they're great parents and they can teach them the migratory route, which they did, but they're also imprinted on sandhills. So famously, cranes don't have mirrors, and so they didn't realize that they were big white birds. Here in the eastern population, probably a result of them being very, very few in number and hanging out with their sandhill cousins, we do have one example of a hybrid chick that was produced out of a sandhill whooping crane pairing from Horicon National Wildlife Refuge. But that's the only one that we've documented. But again, it's probably because he was trying to find a mate and he couldn't find a whooping crane, so decided a sandhill would be just fine.
And on that happy note, hey, listen, if you haven't been to the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo yet, I strongly encourage you to get over there and join up with the organization and support it. Diana Boone and Ann Lacey, thank you so much for representing the organization and for being with us.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening in today. This is a kind of a team effort here. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, part of the Larry Mueller Show, as are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And, of course, our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Been a lot of fun and interesting times here on the show today. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.